This afternoon on the North Carolina Reading Service. At noon, we will read sports, food, and dining sections from today's News and Observer. Carolinian, Washington Daily, Carteret News, Greensboro News and Record, and Winston-Salem Journal. At 1:30, Resource and Recreation. At 2 o'clock, Children's Story Hour. At 3 o'clock, Modern Maturity. At 3:30, Smithsonian Magazine. At 4 o'clock, Potpourri. At 4:30, Out in the Garden. At 5 p.m., we will replay this morning's readings from the News and Observer.
Hi, I'm Kurt Benrood, your host of Movie and Theater Previews, your source of information about movies, plays, and other events that are available in our area with audio description. We air twice each month, once as an episode of Independent Living at 8:30 on the second Tuesday, and a new episode as part of Potpourri at 4 o'clock on the fourth Wednesday. Stay up to date and catch us both times.
Good afternoon. This is the North Carolina Reading Service. Today is Wednesday, June 11th, and welcome to our afternoon news program. Your readers are Jenny Gunther and
Chris Boyer.
Today we'll be reading from the food and the living and sports sections of the News and Observer, the Carolinian, Greensboro News and Record, the Winston-Salem Journal, Washington Daily, and the Carteret News. Articles are read as printed. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's noon broadcast is generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenser. Following our news at noon at 1:30 will be our featured program, R&R, Resource and Recreation. For now, we'll begin with sports from the News and Observer, and Chris will roll things off.
What UNC's Bill Belichick said about building his program and noise around it. Bill Belichick came striding into the Hall of Honor at the Keenan Football Center for a media session Tuesday, saying, "Who has the balloon concession here?" It was a joke, a Bill Belichick joke, said quickly and in a low monotone. It was about an abundance of blue and white balloons that adorned the lobby at North Carolina's Football Center, like the setting for a wedding reception or graduation party. It also was just the kind of joke, some of the UNC football players say, that they have come to expect from their new head football coach, the one with all the Super Bowl rings and a reputation of being a crusty, stern, no-nonsense type. Coach has a narrative of being serious all the time, but coach jokes with us, laughs with us, wide receiver Jordan Shipp said Tuesday. He has a humorous side to him as well. Like the first meeting, you're expecting him to be serious, 100% locked in, and he comes in and introduces himself, and then he busts a joke. Belichick, who can be 100% locked in, said again Tuesday that his focus strictly was on the building of his first college football team, and that he will continue to do it, strenuously, while ignoring what he called the noise out there. In a 20-minute question-and-answer briefing, Belichick touched on putting together his roster on quarterbacks, Gio Lopez and Max Johnson, on revenue sharing in college sports, on the culture, always a buzzword in team sports, in his program, and the players' three-word mantra, be a pro. We'll get players ready to go to the next level. That's what we're selling, and most kids are interested in that. So we have great buy-in, Belichick said. And yes, the 73-year-old Belichick touched on the subject of his 24-year-old girlfriend, Jordan Hudson, the source of many media stories and headlines and social media scuttlebutt and fodder since the two arrived at UNC. There has been constant attention on Hudson, and none more than after Belichick's recent CBS Sunday Morning interview, when she was seen sitting off to the side and objected to a question posed about their relationship. Belichick, for his part, sat still and silently stared ahead after Hudson interjected herself into the questioning. Belichick was asked Tuesday how much of a presence Hudson would have during the football season, if she would be seen on the UNC sideline during games. Belichick chuckled. No, she doesn't have any role in the UNC football program, he said. Again, there's been noise out there about a lot of different things. And again, our focus is day to day, getting better, stacking good days together. How do we help the team get better? That's my job. That's our staff's job, is to put a good plan in place so if they do the work, they see improvement. That's what our job is. Belichick, considered by many the best coach in NFL history, took over at UNC after a year's sabbatical from coaching. Mack Brown, the winningest coach in UNC history, was fired after the 2024 season, and Belichick brought in, amid much fanfare, and given a $10 million a year salary. Belichick's first spring at UNC included such changes as having the players wearing uniforms without numbers at practice. Nor did they wear numbered jerseys during an open practice for Carolina fans at Keenan Stadium, leaving many to guess as to who they were seeing catch passes or make tackles. Four players were at Tuesday's press conference, the first media interviews by UNC players since the Tar Heels' Fenway Bowl appearance in late December. Two were at UNC last season, Shipp and safety Will Hardy. Two have come to UNC in the Belichick program through the portal, offensive lineman Christo Kelly and defensive back Thad Dixon. Shipp, a sophomore from Charlotte, recalled first getting the word that Belichick would be the new coach, that Bill Belichick, the one who coached the New England Patriots to all those Super Bowl titles. It was like, that's the greatest coach of all time, and he's about to be coaching us, Shipp said. The players had to wonder how much would change. Shipp said the program, self-professed as the NFL's 33rd team, is being run differently. It's more like an NFL-style program with the training, the recovery stuff, the strength and conditioning, he said. Belichick's first UNC team will take the field for the first time September 1st against Texas Christian. Keenan Stadium should be full, the anticipation high. ESPN will show it. Many in the nation will be watching, wondering how Belichick's future into college coaching will unfold. Until then, much work needs to be done, Belichick said. We don't think we're there yet, he said. We're definitely not there. We know we have a long way to go, but I think these guys have a really good future in front of them individually and collectively, and it's exciting to see the progress they've made.
Murray State Baseball eliminates Duke Blue Devils to reach College World Series. Omaha remains just out of reach for Duke Baseball. A late-game collapse spelled disaster for the Blue Devils in a 5-4 loss to Murray State in Monday's winner-take-all game of the NCAA Durham Super Regional. The Racers spoiled Duke's College World Series hopes on Jack Coombs Field, clinching a spot in Omaha for the first time. Duke carried a 3-2 lead into the seventh inning, but the Racers tied the game when Jonathan Hogarth belted his second home run of the game in the top of the seventh. Murray State then took the lead for good with two more runs in the top of the eighth inning and held on, preventing Duke, 41-21, from making its first College World Series appearance since 1961. That's one of the best offenses that we've run up against all season, Duke's head coach Chris Pollard said. The kids were tough. They didn't break down to the moment. The teams combined for six home runs, and it was Luke Misstone's tie-breaking homer in the top of the eighth that pushed the Racers over the edge. Murray State, at 44-15, is the fourth number four seed to ever advance to the MCWS and the first Missouri Valley Conference team to reach Omaha since 2003. Hopefully, it motivates everybody, Murray State head coach Don Skirka said. This team could do it with 28 newcomers and three new coaches. They came together and hit their stride at the right time. Duke's final home run in the bottom of the eighth wasn't enough to save the Blue Devils' season. and their 64-year Omaha drought continues. In similar fashion to Sunday's game, Hogarth cranked a leadoff home run over the left field wall. Carson Garner followed it up with a double, and Dom Decker batted him in with a single up the middle. The Racers loaded the bases, stringing together five hits. Freshman starting pitcher Henry Zetkowski escaped the inning with the Blue Devils trailing 2-0. Yesterday, he ambushed a first-pitch fastball. And so today, we were going to go heavy breaking ball, Pollard said. That's Henry Zetkowski's best swing-and-miss pitch. His slider to a right-handed hitter is the best swing-and-miss he has. He'd thrown it twice and gotten bad swings. A bad take and a bad swing. And then, all of a sudden, you get an on-time swing and he hits it 400 feet. Zetkowski recovered, collecting a career-high 7 strikeouts in 4 innings. Duke punched back in the bottom of the first. First baseman Jake Hyde hit a sacrifice fly to right field to plate shortstop Wallace Clark, who drew a leadoff walk and advanced to second on a single from A.J. Garcia. Hyde followed with a home run to center field in the third to knot the game at 2-2. Then, second baseman Jake Berger, who entered Monday going 0-5 with 2 walks in the Super Regional Series, led off the fourth inning with a home run, soaring just 3 feet over the center field wall to give Dukes its first lead of the night at 3-2. After 5 scoreless innings that saw only 1 hit from the Racers, Hogarth tied it back up with another home run in the top of the 7th, nailing a ball 413 feet over the left field fence. Mistone rocketed another long ball to the same spot, retaking the lead for Murray State in the top of the 8th. Then Dan Talkin's RBI triple pushed the Racers' lead to 5-3. They're just so good at bat-to-ball, Pollard said. They're really, really good at 2 strikes. They center the ball really well. It's probably a combination of having some guys that have all had skill set, and they happen to be in the same lineup together. In the bottom of the inning, Duke sophomore catcher Macon Winslow sent the 6th home run of the night to left field with 2 outs to pull the Blue Devils within 1. Duke had life in the bottom of the 9th when Clark was hit by an inside breaking ball with nobody out. After a Garcia foul out, the Blue Devils' season nearly ended on a rare runner's interference call for an illegal slide in second on what could have been a double play off the bat of Ben Miller. The Racers even stormed the field in celebration. But officials overturned the call. Clark was still out at second, but Miller was safe at first. Duke pinch ran for Miller, but the Racers reset and Graham Kelham got Hyde to ground out to first base to end the game. The 4th time in the past 7 NCAA tournaments, the Blue Devils' season ended in a super regional. We've won so many ball games over the years, Pollard said. We won so many big ball games. ACC championships, regional championships, and ball games that we had to win in the regular season to go to the NCAA tournament. Must-win kind of ball games. It's hard for me to reconcile why we haven't been able to do it in this particular kind of game. Do we have more sports?
We do.
Okay.
Prominent Clemson basketball staff member leaving for new job at Duke. A prominent Clemson basketball staffer is leaving for a role at Duke. The Blue Devils and Coach John Shire announced on Wednesday that they'd hired Preston Green as their new director of sports performance. Green, a Clemson graduate, had previously been working as the Tigers' director of men's basketball sport performance under Brad Brownell since the 2023-24 season. It was considered a big win for Clemson when Brownell hired Green back to Clemson after he spent 14 combined seasons working at Miami and Florida. Green, a 1999 Clemson alum, had previously worked at the school from 2009 to 11. Of his 2023 rehiring, Brownell described Green as one of the most respected strength coaches in our business. Shire on Wednesday described Green as a transformational addition to a Duke team that made the Final Four last year. Green replaces Will Stevens, who retired last week after 27 years as Duke basketball's head sports performance coach under Mike Krzyzewski and Shire. In Green's first year back on campus, Clemson won 24 games and advanced to the Elite Eight for only the second time in program history, and first since 1980. The Tigers also won a school record 27 games and 18 ACC games this season. Green has 30-plus years of strength and conditioning experience and was part of Miami's 2022-23 team that reached the Final Four. During his 11 years at Florida, the Gators averaged 22 wins per season and produced NBA players Bradley Beal and Dorian Finney-Smith. Green has also worked at Stanford and Charlotte. Green's most recent salary at Clemson was not immediately available.
We're turning now to the food and living section of the News and Observer. With Hershey's challenges Pokemon fans with limited edition release. In an update no one saw coming, Hershey's just made a pretty cool announcement regarding one of its most popular treats. The popular candy company revealed on Wednesday that it had partnered with another equally iconic name for a limited edition release heading to shelves nationwide soon, and it's challenging fans to try and catch them all. Similar to previous collaborations, Hershey Kisses are getting a makeover. Well, at least their shiny little jackets are. The limited edition Hershey's Kisses features over 150 unique foil designs, all of which were inspired by original Kanto region Pokemon characters, per the June 11th release, including Bulbasaur, Clefairy, Diglett, Eevee, Jigglypuff, Magikarp, Mew, Mr. Mime, Pikachu, Psyduck, Sandshrew, Snorlax, and more.
The folks behind Raleigh's Top Burger are set to open a new neighborhood bar. Neuse River Brewing owners Jennifer and Ryan Kolarov teamed up with Carl Boyajian to open Blotto, named for an old-school term for having a few too many. We were working on names, and Carl said it, and I just stopped and said, "What does that mean?" "It sounded cool," Ryan Kolarov said. "I'd never heard it before. When I said it in front of my grandparents, they just laughed." In Neuse River, the owners have found success with Belgian beers and a beloved burger, named the best in the city by readers of the News and Observer. With Blotto, Ryan Kolarov said they're aiming for something even more casual, a bar to be embraced by the neighborhood around it. "It's just an old-school kind of bar, nothing too crazy," Kolarov said. "It's for the folks on this side of town who want to grab a drink but don't want to mess with downtown." Blotto opens in a 2,500-square-foot space and will have an outdoor patio. The inside is dark with brass accents on the wraparound wooden bar and a mural of a lion on the wall. The drinks are simple, with 8 draft lines, including a nitro one for the silky black stout Guinness, often a dive bar staple.
A new speakeasy with Prohibition-era vibes is planned for downtown Durham. The Red Phone Booth, a nightlife brand with locations in Atlanta, Miami, and Nashville, will open its first North Carolina location in downtown Durham. The private club is best known for its dramatic entrance, a red London-style phone booth where members and guests punch in codes to step inside an inconspicuous door. The Durham Red Phone Booth will be owned by Ralph Mensa and Michael Thomas, local dentist and whiskey enthusiast, making their first foray into the bar business. Mensa said he visited a Red Phone Booth in Nashville 3 years ago and hoped to bring the experience to Durham. "For me, it's the authentic feel of a speakeasy," Mensa said. "The Red Phone Booth is like a time machine with a Prohibition-era ambience in place, plus the team of employees that serves you." For now, the new location is still a secret, but Mensa expects the bar to open in late 2025 or early 2026. The club has several membership levels with escalating perks, including private cigar humidors and sofa reservations ranging from $400 single memberships to $4,000 corporate levels, good for six people. Durham's creative energy, walkable downtown, and a spirit of innovation make it a natural fit for Red Phone Booth, said Stephen DeHaan, founder of Red Phone Booth Hospitality and parent company Roaring Franchises, in a release. With a mayor who's already experienced our concept and a vibrant mix of universities, culture, and tech, Durham offers the ideal backdrop for our immersive Prohibition-era experience. We're excited to partner with Ralph and Michael, who exemplify our commitment to excellence. Mensa expects the Durham location to be around 4,000 square feet, including a cocktail bar and cigar lounge. Beyond the drinks, expect Neapolitan-inspired pizza and charcuterie boards. We'll share more information when we learn where Durham's Red Phone Booth will eventually land.
A beloved fusion restaurant will close in Chapel Hill after more than a decade. A beloved Asian fusion restaurant in Chapel Hill will close this month after more than a decade in business. In 2012, when On Cuisines was one of the Triangle's buzziest and most popular restaurants, Chef Michael Chuang left the hot spot and struck out on his own. Elements, the restaurant he'd open and own, would continue Chuang's style of elevated Asian fusion for 14 more years. Elements will close Saturday, June 21st, the restaurant announced Tuesday, June 10th, on social media. With heavy hearts, we have made the difficult decision to close Elements, the restaurant posted on Facebook. We truly appreciate all the love and support to our family. Though it's the end of an era of sorts, the Chuang family will continue to operate MC Restaurant in Cary, another Asian fusion restaurant opened in 2020. When Chuang left the acclaimed On Cuisines in 2012, he was able to open Elements as his very own restaurant. Something he told the News and Observer in 2013 was his lifelong dream. In a review of Elements in 2013, former NNO dining critic Greg Cox found a lot to love. The lobster and melon salad was a favorite at On Cuisines in Cary. Michael Chuang has found a strong following in Chapel Hill, Cox wrote. No doubt plenty of loyal fans make the drive from Cary, too. But now they're eating in Michael Chuang's restaurant.
Turning now to the Carolinian. Unearthing Raleigh's Roots of Hope, a profound journey into Dix Park's legacy. As Raleigh continues its dynamic evolution, the very land beneath our feet often holds narratives of profound depth, waiting patiently for dedicated storytellers to bring them into the light. The City of Raleigh's YouTube.com video, Roots of Hope, Rediscovering the Legacy of John Hunter, is a masterful example of this crucial work, offering viewers an illuminating and deeply moving exploration of the Dix Park site, a place that is so much more than just a destination for recreation. It's a testament to resilience, a chronicle of our shared, complex history, and a vibrant reminder of the enduring power of family. The documentary meticulously peels back the layers of time, beginning with the city's 2015 acquisition of the former Dix Hospital, North Carolina's first asylum. Yet, as the film compellingly reveals, this chapter was preceded by a century and a half where the land functioned as a plantation, its prosperity built by enslaved Africans. It's from this dark past, as the video courageously frames it, that an extraordinary story of hope and generational strength emerges, centered on the life of John Hunter, born into enslavement in the 1760s, and his descendants. What follows is a captivating account of historical detective work spearheaded by the City of Raleigh Museum with the support from the Dix Park Conservancy. We journey with researcher Ernest Dollar. He and his team navigate the challenging terrain of African-American genealogy, piecing together John Hunter's life and lineage from faded census records and a pivotal obituary. It's a narrative that underscores a profound truth voiced in the film: the immense value in knowing that before you there were individuals who led ordinary lives, but they did extraordinary things. And extraordinary they were. The lineage of John Hunter unfolds to reveal a tapestry woven with incredible threads of American history. His son-in-law, Stuart Ellison, an enslaved carpenter who helped build the very asylum on the Hunter plantation grounds, later became a state legislator and a renowned builder. Descendants include Tuskegee Airmen, pioneers in modern dance, leaders on Wall Street, politicians, and dedicated community figures. This is not merely a historical account. It's an inspirational chronicle of breaking barriers and shaping society against formidable odds. Perhaps the most resonant aspect of Roots of Hope is the raw, palpable emotion of John Hunter's living descendants as they are invited to Raleigh in 2019. For many, their rich ancestral connection to the city was a revelation. Watching them connect with their newfound cousins, walk the grounds their ancestors shaped, from the Spring Hill Plantation House to the hallowed, though often unmarked, graves in Mount Hope Cemetery, to St. Paul's AME Church, a structure linked to their own kin, is an experience that transcends the screen. It's a beautifully orchestrated, memorable experience of discovery and homecoming. One descendant beautifully articulates being overcome with joy at understanding the instrumental role their forefathers played in establishing Raleigh. This film does more than just recount history. It actively makes history by fostering connection. Connection to a place, to a past, and most vitally, to people. It's a powerful reminder for us at the Carolinian and for our entire community that the parks we cherish and the city we inhabit are layered with stories of struggle, resilience, and triumph. Roots of Hope encourages us to look deeper, to support such vital historical recovery efforts, and to understand that by confronting all aspects of our past, we build a more informed, empathetic, and ultimately stronger future. This is more than a documentary. It's an invitation to engage with our city's soul. It's a testament to the idea that within every plot of land, within every researched archive, lie opportunities to unearth stories that can reshape our understanding and inspire us all. Great.
Durham County commemorates Juneteenth with third annual ceremony. In honor of the Juneteenth holiday, the third annual North Carolina official Juneteenth flag-raising ceremony was held Monday outside the Durham County Courthouse. This year marked the fourth year since Durham County government officially recognized Juneteenth as a county holiday. In the third year, the Juneteenth flag has been raised in front of county buildings. The ceremony served as the official kickoff to the 20th annual NC Juneteenth celebration, set to take place on Saturday, June 21st. A major highlight of the event was the hoisting of the Juneteenth flag by the Montford Point Marines and the Durham County Sheriff's Honor Guards. The Montford Point Marines were the first African Americans to serve in the U.S. Marine Corps, trained at segregated facilities in Jacksonville, North Carolina, between 1942 and 1949. Over 20,000 black Marines from this unit paved the way for military integration and made significant contributions to the broader civil rights movement. The event featured remarks and participation from local leaders, including Durham County Sheriff Clarence F. Burkhead, Durham County Manager Claudia Hager, and City of Durham Mayor Leonardo Williams. CBS 17 anchor Rod Carter served as the master of ceremonies. Sheriff Burkhead spoke on the deeper meaning of the day. For me, today is a day to reflect on the long struggle for freedom and equality and to remember the ongoing fight against racism and inequality. Today, we confront new challenges, but we are a resilient people. Mayor Williams emphasized the city's role as a model for perseverance and progress by pointing to the evolution of the city of Durham. We are not only located in the middle of the state, but I do think that Durham is going to be where the example is set of how we become our own reprise, how we bounce back, Williams said. Look back. It has happened before. We've been through tougher times than now. We know how to overcome it. The Juneteenth flag was raised shortly after the singing of the national anthem by Dr. Charity Godfrey Davis. A central part of the ceremony was the Juneteenth story, presided over by Attorney Larry Hall, former Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Military and Veteran Affairs. Hall explained how enslaved people sought refuge in Union-conquered areas, where they were eventually classified as contraband of war and not returned to Confederate slaveholders. These contraband camps became places of hope and survival, growing near Union forts throughout the South. Hall continued by highlighting the preliminary freedom papers. President Lincoln issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in September 1862, which took effect on January 1, 1863, right in the middle of the Civil War. Durham City Manager Bowman Ferguson gave a stirring reading of Lincoln's official proclamation, which declared that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious states and territories are, and henceforward shall be, free. When the Union advanced throughout the South, the number of contraband camps grew, more than 100 by the war's end. These camps provided refuge for black families and later became centers for enlistment into the United States Colored Troops. Over 200,000 black men served in these segregated military units. Among them, 15 U.S. Colored Troop soldiers, 8 Union Navy sailors, and 3 soldiers from other units would go on to receive the Medal of Honor, the highest military decoration in the country. Durham County Commissioner Wendy Jacobs continued the narrative by reading from the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. She detailed how it was passed in the Senate in 1864 and after strategic maneuvering by the Lincoln administration, passed in the House in 1865. Though Lincoln signed the joint resolution, he did not live to see its full ratification later that year. The climax of the historical recounting came with a remembrance of June 19, 1865, when over 4,000 Union colored troops accidentally landed in Galveston, Texas, and delivered the news of freedom to enslaved people who had yet to hear it. The moment was cemented with General Order No. 3, which was posted on the door of a local black church, formally notifying the public of emancipation and the federal enforcement of it. Phyllis Coley, N.C. Juneteenth State Director under the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation, closed the ceremony. She reminded attendees of the legislative journey that made Juneteenth a national holiday, including President Joe Biden signing into law in 2021. The ceremony was hosted by Spectacular Magazine, the Triangle Cultural Awareness Foundation, and the Durham County Government.
Community Health and Wellness Fair successfully brings vital resources and youth empowerment. This is out of Durham. The Community Health and Wellness Fair, led by Dr. Wanda Boone, CEO, Together for Resilient Youth, Kirsten L. Ingram, the MPH Executive Director, Holistic Health Empowerment, Lily A. Hill, MSN, BSN, RN from Durham Technical Community College, and Latoria Dowdy from Heaven Sent Catering, successfully gathered community members for a transformative event dedicated to youth empowerment and public health. Hosted at Durham Technical Community College, the fair provided essential resources, health education, and interactive engagement opportunities for attendees. The fair opened with a powerful Youth Health Ambassadors segment, where young leaders addressed urgent topics including gun violence, stress, bullying, vaping, and substance use, fostering critical discussions on community challenges. This dialogue reinforced the role of youth leadership in advocating for positive change. Throughout the morning, attendees engaged with health experts on mental health, heart disease, diabetes, nutrition and exercise, lung cancer prevention, with specialized stations supporting chronic disease prevention and overall wellness. Thanks to the Durham County Department of Health and Human Services, DCDHHS, free naxalone distribution furthered public safety efforts. The event featured a diverse array of vendors and organizations providing critical services, like the North Carolina Advisory Committee on Cancer Care and Coordination's Prevention Subcommittee. They shared vaping and tobacco cessation materials and Quitline NC referrals to encourage healthy behavior. Community Health Coalition provided health education materials and blood pressure screenings, helping attendees monitor their wellness. Durham County Department of Health and Human Services offered naxalone, along with healthy eating, diet, exercise, and diabetes education resources to support chronic disease prevention. Lincoln Community Health Center graciously donated drawstring book bags, hand sanitizers, and clinic health education materials, ensuring attendees left with valuable tools for establishing a medical home. Interactive wellness activities. A line dancing session featuring the electric slide and boots on the ground kept energy high and encouraged physical activity in a fun, engaging way. Attendees also participated in Operation Medicine Drop, a secure, safe way to dispose of unused or expired medications facilitated by sheriff's office representatives. The fair provided a valuable opportunity for attendees to learn more about clinical trials as a pathway to advancing medical research and improving health outcomes. Trained professionals were on site to discuss the importance of clinical trial participation, ensuring individuals understood how research contributes to better treatment options and equitable access to care. In alignment with the AACI Clinical Research Innovation Strategic Goals, specialists highlighted barriers to participation, the significance of diverse representation in trials, and how informed engagement can lead to groundbreaking medical advancements. These conversations reinforced the need for community-driven approaches that empower individuals to make informed health decisions and contribute to life-saving research. With strong attendance and active participation, the Community Health and Wellness Fair successfully fostered conversations around youth leadership, public safety, and proactive health management. Attendees left with not only valuable information, but also tangible resources to support their health wellness journeys. Kirsten L. Ingram, MPH Executive Director of Holistic Health Empowerment, emphasized the importance of addressing mental health, positive conflict resolution, and bullying prevention as key strategies for long-term wellness. Events like the Community Health and Wellness Fair demonstrate the power of education, engagement, and action in shaping healthier communities. Mental health awareness, positive conflict resolution strategies, and bullying prevention must be prioritized to empower individuals, particularly youth, to navigate weathering experiences and life challenges with resilience coping strategies. When we foster positive, healthy behaviors and reduce exposure to stressors, we lay the foundation for improved well-being and chronic disease prevention, an approach deeply aligned with the mission of the American Public Health Association. Do we have another from Carolinian?
We do. It's pretty long, though.
Let's go ahead and give it a try.
All right. A seat at the Queen's table. North Carolina Black Alliance cultivates healing and connection for women. On Saturday, May 31st, the North Carolina Black Alliance hosted its May edition of the Queen's Table Brunch Series, and it was an experience that resonated deeply with the promise of its design. An intentional, exclusive gathering for women rooted in connection, culture, and profound community care. Stepping into St. Mark's Church in Smithfield, North Carolina, the vibe was calm, sincere, and fragrant florals adorned by an abundance of flowers that hinted at the beauty and growth to unfold. Inspired by the seven principles of Kwanzaa, this month's brunch settled on Ujima, collective work and responsibility. This powerful principle was thoughtfully woven into a vital discussion on Black women's mental health, a topic handled with incredible grace and insight. Guiding the conversation was the esteemed Reverend Yolanda Murphy, a local author and healthcare advocate whose work, including her poignant book, Still Standing, Dealing with Grief, Loss, and Sickness, provided a powerful foundation for the day. What transpired was far more than a discussion. It was a collective exhale. Reverend Murphy, along with our host Faith Howell, cultivated an atmosphere of profound honesty where women shared stories of real and impactful loss. The dialogue courageously addressed the unique ways Black women navigate their emotions, particularly with a society that often compels a facade of unwavering strength, regardless of the personal battles being fought. There was an undeniable sense of shared understanding, punctuated by heartfelt hugs and, yes, some cathartic tears, all held within a circle of unwavering support. The brilliance of the Queen's Table was not just in the dialogue, but in the tangible acts of care. In a particularly moving segment, attendees were invited to build flower bouquets infused with a motivational message. Then, in a powerful embodiment of Ujima and sisterhood, we were encouraged to give another woman her flowers, a deeply symbolic gesture of recognition, encouragement, and shared strength. As the event drew to a close, the sentiment was universal. Everyone left full from brunch from the word and with a bouquet to keep them encouraged. It was a holistic nourishment for the body, the spirit, and the soul. The attention to detail, from the elegant tea attire to the pervasive sense of solidarity, crafted a truly memorable experience. My deepest gratitude extends to the North Carolina Black Alliance for their unwavering commitment to continuing to create space for the community to connect, build, and grow together. The Queen's Table offers not just a momentary reprieve, but also tools for integrating self and community care, information on vital resources, and a subtle yet firm reminder of the political lens through which mental health equity must be viewed. I, like many others who attended, eagerly anticipate the next iteration of this exceptional series. For any woman seeking a sacred space for meaningful dialogue, leadership development, and collective healing, the Queen's Table is an invitation to be seen, heard, and deeply valued. Check out North Carolina Black Alliance on Mobilize to learn of more events.
It's time now for a few announcements. Have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of the Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on a AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell the note's denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at www.bep.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor, who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit www.bep.gov or call toll-free 844-815-9388. That number again is 844-815-9388. Tactile tours are available at the North Carolina Museum of Art. These tours are designed for visitors who are blind or have low vision. These docent-led tours explore the museum's collection through audio description, tactile experiences, and by engaging the senses. Tours are available by request only. You must arrange them at least 2 weeks in advance. To schedule a tactile tour, please contact Accessibility Coordinator Molly Hull at mhull@ncartmuseum.org or call 919-664-6854. That number is 919-664-6854. This announcement from the Disability Rights of North Carolina, DRNC. Our work is being threatened. Can we count on you so our community can continue to count on us? Did you know this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Protection and Advocacy, the PNA Network? As North Carolina's designated PNA, Disability Rights North Carolina has proudly carried out our federally mandated mission, protecting and advocating for the rights of people with disabilities across our state. Funding cuts threaten the services and protections we provide to individuals with disabilities and those who love and care for them. This isn't just a budget line. This is about real people losing access to education, health care, safe housing, and the support they need to live with dignity and independence. We are proud of what we've accomplished, but we cannot continue this work without your support. We urge you to act now to protect the rights and safety of disabled North Carolinians. Together, we've built something powerful over the last 50 years. Let's make sure it lasts for the next 50 and beyond. To find out how you can help, go to disabilityrightsnc.org/take-action. And I'll spell that out. Disability, disabilityrightsnc.org/take-action. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assistive technology device, such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, "Tune in NC Reading Service" to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following their initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. We're going to turn now to the Washington Daily.
McBeast donation supports fire and emergency management training at Beaufort County Community College. Beaufort County Community Colleges, also known as Beaufort CCC, Fire and Emergency Management Program, is expanding its training capabilities thanks to a $15,000 donation from YouTube creator MrBeast, helping the program meet updated National Fire Protection Association, also known as NFPA, standards. Earlier this year, MrBeast filmed a video using the public safety driving pad on Beaufort Community College's campus. In appreciation for the college's support, he offered a donation to the program. The funds are allowing the program to replace outdated gear and meet new technical rescue requirements, including upgraded equipment for rope rescue. NFPA guidelines require life safety equipment such as ropes and harnesses to be replaced every 10 years, even if unused, to ensure safety and reliability during training and emergency responses. Some of our equipment had reached the end of its service life, and we were facing a shortfall in updating it, said Brian Pasco, Fire and Emergency Management Online Coordinator. This donation lets us replace everything at once rather than gradually. Now, everything is standardized and integrates properly. The new gear supports instruction in technical rescue, particularly the foundational technical rescue rope course taught in the college's daytime fire academy. Rope rescue provides the basis for advanced certifications such as trench, confined space, structural collapse, vehicle, and water rescues. Each scenario relies on rope systems for lowering, raising, or stabilizing individuals and equipment. These are entry-level students, so we're responsible for teaching them from the ground up, said an instructor. Rope training lays the groundwork for more advanced rescue certifications as they progress in their careers. Beyond improving instruction, the donation enables the program to establish a consistent replacement schedule for gear moving forward. Rope and rescue equipment can be expensive. A single 200-foot rope often used in training costs around $600, and multiple ropes are needed for each scenario. This support gives our students access to industry-standard tools from day one, said staff. It's a big step forward for our program. For more information about the Fire and Emergency Management Program at Beaufort CCC, visit, oh my goodness, this is a long website, https://www.beaufort, that's spelled B as in baby, E-A-U, F as in Frank, O-R-T, C-C-C, /continuing-education/public-safety/emergency-medical-services/ fire training, or call 252-940-6375. That number again is 252-940-6375.
Underground Railroad Museum celebrates Juneteenth one step at a time. It took 913 days after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation for news of the emancipation to reach the enslaved in Galveston, Texas. In honor of that, the Washington Waterfront Underground Railroad Museum will celebrate that historic day. As part of our historic walking tour, we will commemorate Juneteenth by walking from the museum to the proposed site of Freedom Park at the corner of 4th and Van Norden Streets, said Lisa Jones, director of the museum. I have carefully measured it out, and it is exactly 913 steps. So, at 9:13 a.m. on the morning of June 21st, we will make our way from the museum to the proposed park site. It is important because it is paramount to celebrate and recognize the significant and profound impact of freedom from slavery and the long struggle for that freedom. It is a celebration of freedom commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. Following the walk, they will make their way back to the museum. Between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., there will be a Juneteenth flag raising, where black soldiers from the Washington area who fought during the Civil War will be recognized. There will also be a Freedom Tree, a 6-foot Christmas tree that people will be encouraged to come by and decorate with pre-made ornaments, donning the colors of the African flag, red, green, and black. There will also be a children's reading hour from books about Juneteenth, along with Juneteenth Jeopardy, Bingo, a Juneteenth scavenger hunt, and Juneteenth A to Z. Our whole idea is to not interfere with any of the other events, like the parade and the Freedom Festival at Beebe Memorial Park later in the day, said Jones, but to draw people to Washington earlier in the day and hope that they will stay for the whole day and be a part of all the amazing things happening that weekend as we celebrate Juneteenth.
Community members give Snowden students final send-off. Aurora area residents gathered at 12:15 p.m. on Friday, June 6th at S.W. Snowden Elementary School to give students a final send-off. Students who attended Snowden this year are the last students to ever walk its hallways. On Tuesday, June 3rd, the Beaufort County Board of Education voted 6-3 to permanently close Snowden due to decreasing student population and lack of essential funding. Students, depending on their grade level, will either attend Chocowinity Primary School or Chocowinity Middle School. Students also have the option to attend another school within Beaufort County if space is available, a private or charter school, or attend a school in Pamlico County. Students who move to Chocowinity Primary or Middle will not have to register, according to Beaufort County Schools.
Law enforcement agencies take part in annual torch run for Special Olympics. Several different agencies carried the torch and showed their support at the Law Enforcement Torch Run for Special Olympics on Tuesday. The run was held after a previous event was rained out. Joining the Beaufort County Sheriff's Office were deputies, troopers, and officers from the Washington Police Department, NC State Highway Patrol, NC Marine Fisheries, and the NC Department of Corrections. The run began and ended at Mac Bear Hodges Festival Park in downtown Washington. It began at 10 a.m. and circled different parts of the downtown area. Different runners took part in carrying the torch along the path. Beaufort County Sheriff Scott Hammonds was part of a ceremony that was held to recognize the event and the efforts from the run. Volunteers and athletes from the Beaufort Hyde Special Olympics also participated. According to the Sheriff's Office Facebook page, the NC Law Enforcement Torch Run has raised over $920,000 in fundraising. The goal is $2.25 million. You can go to the Sheriff's Office Facebook page to make a contribution and to purchase a T-shirt to support the cause. They are $20 each, with all proceeds going to Special Olympics of North Carolina. We're going to turn now to the Carteret News.
Carteret County Public Library launches Color Our World Summer Reading Program. The Carteret County Public Library System announced today the launch of its 2025 Summer Reading Program, Color Our World, kicking off. This story is dated June 9th. So on Saturday, June 14th, this year's theme, selected by the National Collaborative Summer Library Program, invites readers of all ages to celebrate creativity through painting, drawing, music, theater, textile arts, storytelling, photography, and more. The Color Our World program runs throughout the summer at all five library branches, offering a vibrant lineup of events designed to engage imaginations, support literacy, and strengthen community connections. From hands-on animal-themed writing workshops for children to historical lectures for adults, there is something for every age and interest. Events include Opening Day Celebration, June 14th. Join us at any branch for art-themed activities and register for the summer reading program. All ages welcome. Maritime Museum Family Story Times, June 20th, July 11th and 18th, and August 8th. Ocean-themed stories and science at Newport and Beaufort branches. Whiskers, Words, and Wonders on June 23rd, July 7th, and July 25th. Children ages 6 to 12 can learn about pet care right from a shelter animal's point of view and host a stuffed animal sleepover. Magic Show with Dana Hill, July 30th at the Civic Center. Magician Dana Hill brings his unique blend of laughter and illusion for the whole family. Blackbeard the Pirate, July 16th at Bogue Banks, a swashbuckling story time with the infamous pirate. NC Aquarium Programs, July 31st in Newport and August 7th down east. Book Talk with Barbara McCreary, July 28th at Beaufort. Author-led discussion and art project based on her book, Ebb and Flow, for ages 8 to 12. The Shark Lady Returns, August 2nd at Western Carteret. Learn to identify fossils and shark teeth in back-to-back children's and adult sessions with Dr. Oliphant. Special programs for adults. Fun on the Water, the early days of coastal tourism in Carteret County, June 17th at 10:30 a.m. at Western Carteret. David Bennett, curator at the Maritime Museum, shares how tourism shaped the county from the late 1700s through the early 1900s. Discover the history of Core Banks with Dr. Stan Rule, August 4th at 2 p.m., Beaufort. Dr. Rule presents a captivating slideshow covering key historical moments and coastal culture on the Core Banks. This summer is all about imagination, expression, and community, said Dorothy Howell, library director. Whether you're painting, writing, learning, or just soaking in the stories, Color Our World is a chance for everyone to get inspired and be part of something colorful and fun. Many of these programs are made possible through the generous support of the Friends of the Library groups across Carteret County. Registration begins June 14th at all five branches. Stop by to sign up and pick up your reading log. All events are free and open to the public. To view the full event schedule, visit www.carteretcountypubliclibrary.org. That web address again is www.carteretcountypubliclibrary.org.
And this is a series of brief announcements from the Carolina Coastal Region. Big Rock Festival enters day three with 253 boats on the water and high stakes in play out of Morehead City. After rough seas kept the entire fleet dockside on Tuesday, the 67th annual Big Rock Blue Marlin Tournament resumed in full force Wednesday morning, with 253 boats heading offshore for day three. With only 43 boats having fished Monday and none on Tuesday, the majority of the tournament field is now set to fish four straight days, creating a shootout-style second half of the week. That surge of activity begins today as crews chase a $6.32 million purse and one of sport fishing's most coveted titles. Beaufort Road closure set for this week. For the town of Beaufort, a number of streets through Beaufort will be closed this week as part of the town's ongoing water, sewer, and storm water infrastructure upgrades. During partial lane closures, traffic control measures will be in place. And again, out of Morehead City, swimming advisory issued for popular Soundside locations. Swimmers are advised to avoid two popular Soundside swimming areas in eastern North Carolina after recent water quality tests revealed elevated bacterial levels exceeding state standards. Advisories have been posted for Collington Harbor in Killdevil Hills and Bogue Sound at Sunset Drive in Morehead City. The North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries announced the advisories today, citing concerns over elevated levels of Enterococci bacteria. According to a release from the division, contact with water containing these bacteria can increase the risk of developing gastrointestinal illnesses or skin infections in both people and pets. And lastly, Taste of the South to offer Southern cuisine for a good cause. The Black History Committee and Culinary Arts Program of Carteret Community College are partnering to once again present the Taste of the South, which will take place 6 p.m. June 19th in the college's Hospitality and Culinary Arts Center. This annual tradition invites the community to come together to celebrate the rich heritage, flavors, and spirit of the Southern experience. And we have any more news from Carteret County? Then we'll go ahead and move to Greensboro News and Record.
Guilford Courthouses will offer kiosk access to e-courts system. County courthouses in Graham, Greensboro, and High Point will make an e-courts kiosks available to the public this month. The State Administrative Office of the Courts is in the process of converting paper court files to a cloud-hosted enterprise justice platform, or eCourts. The platform provides the public with electronic filing and a free online search portal for court records. It debuted in April 2024 in Alamance and Guilford counties. The kiosks will provide on-site access to eCourts applications for users to search court dates and case events, file documents electronically, make payments, and use a scanner, printer, or other service available through the judicial branch's digital case management system. Prior to e-courts, most North Carolinians could only access court records and case events at a clerk's office or at a public computer terminal located inside the courthouse. Guilford Group, These kiosks are the next step in ensuring robust public access to the court system, Ryan Boyce, Director of Administrative Office of the Court, said in a statement. For those without internet access, kiosks are a convenient way to access the court system and take advantage of the tools that eCourts provides. The kiosks also provide public access to eCourts' primary applications for search, filing, and user-assisted interviews to help create common legal filings. The eCourts transition is planned for completion by the end of 2025, with appellate courts soon following. Forsyth will go live with 13 other counties: Allegheny, Ashe, Avery, Caswell, Madison, Mitchell, Rockingham, Stokes, Surrey, Watauga, Wilkes, Yadkin, and Yancey on July 21st. Meanwhile, Davidson and Davie will go live with 11 other counties: Alexander, Burke, Caldwell, Catawba, Cleveland, Iredell, Gaston, Lincoln, McDowell, Rowan, and Rutherford will go live on October 13th. In the 73 North Carolina counties using e-courts today, the public can file and access court records and make payments online from anywhere with an internet connection.
Wow. Guilford Board votes to close 4 elementary schools: Washington, Vandalia, Madison, and Southern. Guilford County Schools leaders voted to close 4 elementary schools Tuesday, one of which was under 50% of capacity. The closings will start following the upcoming school year. Washington, Vandalia, and Madison elementary schools will remain open another year and close during the 2026-27 school year. Southern Elementary is set to close for the 27-28 school year. The closings are expected to save Guilford County Schools $1.7 million in operational costs, according to Julius Monk, Deputy Superintendent of Business and Operations for the district. Washington Elementary is built for 514 students, but had 215 enrolled during the 2024-25 school year. The students and staff will be absorbed by schools whose boundaries are being redrawn to include them. Superintendent Whitney Oakley said the plan aligns resources to better serve students. Stokes school officials admit they chose wrong valedictorian. It's hard, Oakley acknowledged at the Guilford County Schools Board of Education meeting on Tuesday. While the public hearing before the vote did not draw a crowd, two parents spoke with resignation at what was proposed. "It is a shame that money trumps what is best for our children in our society," said Southern parent Carmen Green. "We have been able to create a supportive and nurturing community. Our principal, Mr. Jonathan Moore, let the students duct tape him to the wall and dunk him in a booth, all in the name of education. He was able to individually meet with our third through fifth grade students before the EOGs, the end of grade test, to remind them to take their time and do their best. Staff go above and beyond to make sure children have everything they need to succeed," she said. "This environment cannot be recreated in a larger elementary school," Green said. Julie Robbins said that Washington Elementary had been a school of choice for her family for the past 9 years. "They have learned all their basics," Robbins said of her children. "They have also learned how to ask for help when they need it, and to offer help when they see a need. They have learned how to make the goals of their community their own. I will be forever grateful that my family has had the chance to be a part of the Washington Elementary community." Retiring principal Paul Travers has looked at the challenges of his students and staff and finds data-driven ways to keep the school improving and thriving, Robbins said. "I would like to thank the incredible team of educators who respond to the needs of each student individually, who know every single student in that little school by name," Robbins said. "Washington is the heart every community deserves." Each of the votes on the individual schools passed by an 8-to-1 vote, with Kim Airby of District 6 voting against the closings each time. "I felt that it was important to recognize that we did have some pushback about closing schools and what neighborhood schools mean to people," Airby said after the meeting. "I just wanted to show that support." Airby said she understood why the schools must close. "But it's just never an easy thing to close a school," Irby said. "There are so many, many memories that are there. I just felt empathy tonight. I know I didn't have the votes not to close it, so there was no harm in showing the community that came out that I saw them and I heard them." The school system has a neighborhood lookup that allows families to insert addresses to find out school assignments and other information on choices they'll have. Is it going to be the same? No, said District 2 board member Chrissy Pratt, whose district includes Southern Elementary. It's just not. It's going to be different. But I do believe the staff of GCS is working as hard as they can to make it a positive difference. And is there more news from Greensboro?
Yes. Last Rodeo. Marriage Proposal steals the show at Marketplace Cinemas in Winston-Salem. This is a Greensboro, out of the Greensboro paper, however. As James Williams sees things, all the signs pointed to an evening his now fiancée will never forget. The place, the time, the subject of a movie they were about to take in, even the title of the film led Williams to drop to one knee and pop the question in front of an audience of strangers. Our first date was there, Williams said of the Marketplace Cinemas, and the Last Rodeo was playing. It just seemed perfect. Williams knew the movie was coming out. It's about a retired bull rider who decides to get back in the ring, and they wanted to see it as they both loved the rodeo. So an idea began to turn over in his head. Angela Bunting and James Williams are at the same stage in life with grown kids and grandchildren, and they're old enough to know what they want. So it all made sense. Williams could only conclude that the timing would never be better. It's our last rodeo, too, he said with a laugh. We're not doing this anymore. Before he could get down on bended knee, however, Williams had to enlist the help of a few conspirators. We've seen James and Angela many times before, wrote Zach Fox, a manager at Marketplace Cinemas, in an email after the May 23rd proposal. A few minutes after they settled in for their typical evening showtime, Williams excused himself to go to the restroom. It was a ruse, as Williams went to the lobby to ask for help in the setup. James said they had their first rodeo at the cinema and showed us the ring, Fox said. A plan was hatched quickly. Employees agreed to pause the movie just before the lights went down, and Fox would make an announcement that it would resume right after this. Bunting was not expecting a proposal. He pulled me up and got down on one knee, she said. Then I realized what he was doing, but I had no idea that night. Theatergoers were treated to a bonus show and gave the couple an ovation. The couple met in March online, the modern way to explore compatibility, through Facebook dating. They planned a standard first date, dinner and a bite to eat, and hit it off right away. Things moved quickly and they grew inseparable. Marriage seemed the logical conclusion. I've been happier these last 2 months than I have been in decades, Bunting said. Both Williams and Bunting knew full well that there are those who will think 2 months isn't long enough, but neither could care less what anyone else thinks, other than family, that is. When it's right, Williams said. I guess the way I look at it is we've both been married before. We're not naive, and we know what we want. They did, however, want the blessing of their adult children and moved quickly to share the news with those who matter the most. It kind of shocked everybody, Williams allowed. Not to worry, however. Bunting said her children could see how Williams made her laugh and immediately reached the conclusion everybody wants for their loved ones. My kids all said they just want me to be happy, she said. As for the next big occasion, their wedding, Williams has another romantic notion. He'd like to do it on Christmas Day, a true gift. It's hard to find true love, he said. When everything clicks, you know it.
What a great story. We turn now to the Winston-Salem Journal. Krispy Kreme sells remaining stake in Insomnia Cookies subsidiary for $75 million. Krispy Kreme Incorporated said Tuesday it has completed its divestiture of its Insomnia Cookies subsidiary, netting an estimated $75 million in cash proceeds from selling its remaining 34% stake. The company said in July it had sold the majority stake in the subsidiary for $127.4 million to an investor group led by Global Capital Investment from Verlinvest and Mistral Equity Partners. The buyers are Verlinvest Cookies Holding, Inc. and Mistral Sleepless Holdings II, LLC. Krispy Kreme said it will use the $75 million to pay down corporate debt. The company listed having $844.5 million in long-term debt obligations as of December 31st. We continue to take swift, decisive action to deleverage our balance sheet and drive sustainable, profitable growth, Krispy Kreme Chief Executive Josh Charlesworth said in a statement. This is an important step as we focus on our two biggest opportunities, profitable U.S. expansion and capital-light international franchise growth. Insomnia, known for its late-night cookie delivery services, has 277 stores altogether, typically near college campuses. It has expanded its menu to include brownies, cookie cakes, and ice cream. Among its 10 stores in North Carolina are locations at 706 North Trade Street in downtown Winston-Salem, 425 Tate Street in Greensboro, and 128 Appalachian Street in Boone. In May, the company announced as part of its first quarter financial report the pausing of expanding its McDonald's partnership, ending a quarterly dividend payment, and withdrawing its fiscal 2025 financial guidance. The company reported a $33.3 million loss for the first quarter, compared with an $8.5 million loss a year ago. The high-profile McDonald's in-store partnership currently has more than 2,400 participating locations, primarily in the Midwest, but at least 500 in the greater New York City area. Krispy Kreme said in its news release, it is reassessing the deployment schedule together with McDonald's while it works to achieve a profitable business model for all parties.
Winston-Salem looking at unprecedented and historic tax increase. Property owners in Winston-Salem will see a large property tax increase barring any last-minute changes in the city's budget for the next fiscal year. City staff's latest figure shows the council is considering a tax rate of 56.7 cents per $100 of taxable property. For a median Winston-Salem home value of $232,800, that would mean a $93 increase over the revenue neutral rate, or the amount that would keep the money the county takes in from taxes roughly equal to the current fiscal year. The property tax bill would then come out to $1,320 for the average house. The hike is so bad that Robert Clark, the city's finance committee chair, called it unbelievable, historic, and unprecedented. 5, 6, 7, 8% would be high, Clark said in a Monday afternoon meeting. This is just unbelievable. Most of it is totally outside of our control, though. In his words, the city is not spending money on anything new, but rather has lost sources of revenue and is replacing them with property tax in order to keep services going. For example, the city's transit system is losing $27 million in pandemic funding, which helped its fund to remain solvent without additional city money. Now the transit fund has exhausted its remaining fund balance, and close to half of the city's property tax increase over the revenue neutral rate will be used to replace the revenue source. Several city leaders made comparisons from the city's budget cycle to that of Forsyth County, whose commissioners just narrowly passed a budget with a 23% property tax increase. This is every town, city, village in the country, said D.D. Adams, council member and mayor pro tem. That's just the way it is. Goods and services, COVID-19, 3 recessions. It's the way it is. I heard Councilmember Clark when he said the people are going to come for us. They can come, but this won't change, Adams said. Local government authorities in many jurisdictions have struggled to manage the gradual disappearance of COVID-19 pandemic funding, coupled with many economic recessions, inflationary pressure, as well as rising costs for personnel and health care. That's not even to mention the possibility of the federal and state governments suddenly pulling funding from the city's budget. In interviews with the Journal, City Manager Pat Pate has repeatedly expressed how uncertain city staff are on whether Winston-Salem will receive millions of dollars in funding because of massive federal government spending cuts. In response, property taxes are jumping, while the city also increases fees across the board, including higher charges to Winston-Salem citizens and visitors to park downtown. But since the City Council's last deliberation on the upcoming budget, city staff have adjusted the proposal by cutting an extra 0.80 cents off the tax rate to try and get as close to the 1 cent reduction requested by Winston-Salem Mayor Alan Joynes from the proposal of the city manager. Those cuts resulted in what could be $1.8 million less in salary and benefits for city employees, $1.3 million less for transit service, and $100,000 less for the operation of the Benton Convention Center. If the city were to agree on the cuts for the transit system, it would probably mean that routes would stop at 9:30 p.m. instead of 12:30 a.m., though there are other reduction options like cuts to Saturday service or eliminating the lowest used routes. Budget reductions for salary and benefits would realistically look like a 2% cost of living pay adjustment, a 2% pay scales adjustment, and a 2% merit adjustment throughout the next year. That's below changes in Forsyth and Guilford counties, Greensboro and High Point, which average about 3.6%.
Well, that's all the news that we have from the different areas, but we do have some announcements of this evening's television watching. On the ABC channel at 8 o'clock is the NBA Finals. That carries through the evening. The finals is Oklahoma City Thunder at Indiana Pacers. So that's full time on ABC. CBS has Hollywood Squares at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock is Raid the Cage. Those are two game shows. And at 10 o'clock will be The Equalizer, the episode called Deception, where the team suspects Aunt Vi's friend Evelyn is being taken advantage of. On the Fox station, you can watch Master Chef at 8 o'clock. At 9 o'clock is Gordon Ramsay's Secret Service, and then the news comes on at 10. On the NBC network, Chicago Med comes on at 8 o'clock, Chicago Fire at 9 o'clock, and Chicago PD at 10 o'clock. On the PBS network, at 8 o'clock is Nature, the ocean's greatest feast, South Africa's annual summer sardine migration. At 9 o'clock is NOVA, the extreme airport engineering. Designers and engineers build a new airport in New York. And another NOVA episode at 10 o'clock, the London Super Tunnel, where teams build a new subterranean railroad under London. You can watch the ION. Blue Bloods is on all evening at 8 and 9 and 10. And if you're interested in sports, the ESPN has the men and women's college track and field NCAA outdoor championships. And TNT has a run of the Avengers, the movie, Infinity War. And USA has The Mummy. So there's some interesting movies to watch. But that's all the time we have today for the news. This is Jenny Gunther with
Chris Boyer.
And we've been reading selections from the food and dining and sports sections of the News and Observer, the Carolinian, Greensboro News and Record, Winston-Salem Journal, Washington Daily, and the Carteret News. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and readily available as a podcast after this broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Today's noon broadcast was generously underwritten by Christine and Greg Tenser. It's time now for today's R&R, Resource and Recreation Program. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any questions or comments, please call NCRS at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Have a great day. And as always, please stay safe out there.